Yeah, let's start. If anybody,
yellow. Okay, so we're going to start this, the mood, with the most elementary of points. Okay, so it helps if you're going to study the origin of the Haggadah, it helps to first get two obvious terms out of the way. The Haggadah Shel Pesach refers to the manual, the piece of paper, which tells you how to conduct the Seder. And the Seder, which is the next term we're going to discuss, is a halachic construct for all the ceremonies, the ritual, the benedictions, all of the various parts of the celebrating of the night of Pesach. So the word Seder is obviously an Aramaic translation of the Hebrew word Orech or Arach. And this, the Haggadah, as we know it today, obviously is just the manual for how one conducts the Seder. Just like with Tefillah and Sidur, those are two different things, right? You have the Sidur, which is just the manual for how you conduct yourself during the Tefillah and what words you have to say. So as we explore the history of the Haggadah, we have to explore how the Seder evolved into the Haggadah. So we're going to divide this into about three distinct periods. First, let's call this the pre-Seder period, before any such Seder existed. This would be from biblical times all the way until the year 70 of the Common Era, which is roughly the time of the Qurban. Then you'll have the period when the Seder was being developed, which is, you know, roughly the year 70 during the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and all the way until the year 1100 of the Common Era. And then finally, when it was canonized into a book in the years 1100 onwards. So if we think about this period here, the pre-Seder period from the biblical times all the way to the Churban Beit HaMikdash, the only information we have from that period of what it was like to celebrate Pesach in that time would be from the scriptures themselves, from the Pesukim. And we have very, very little data of what it must have been like to celebrate Pesach. Obviously, the Chachamim were not yet born, so we don't have any of the Mitzvot Rabbanan. You don't have four Kosot, you don't have the Kittel, you don't have Manishtana, you don't have any of the Midrashim, which were written by the Tanaim. There's probably no Birkat HaMazon or Kiddush in the forms that we know them. And so it's very difficult to understand how people would have celebrated Pesach in the time of the Nevi'im and all the way until the Beit HaMikdash. Our best guess is that it would be a very Korban-oriented affair. So it would largely revolve around the Korban in the Beit HaMikdash. And that's what would make the Korban Pesach, and that's what would make people's Pesach. There was obviously they would eat matzah, maror, no chametz, and the Korban Pesach was the center of their Pesach. There was no idea for them to have a home like the ceremony as we understand today, as far as we know. There's no Maxwell House Haggadah in their heads. This was their Pesach. Now, exactly who celebrated Pesach is up to our imagination. Most of the Jews who were religious enough were going to be Olei Regel to the Beit HaMikdash. People who are not so religious might have done a Bama, where they might not have celebrated at all, but this is all obviously conjecture. Now, outside of Tanakh, we have almost no data as to what exactly people were doing during Pesach time or how they celebrated Pesach, except for one tiny piece of papyrus that you're looking at now. This piece of papyrus is called the Passover Letter. It is 2,400 years old, from the year 419 BCE. And to give you a context of how long ago that is, this was written when Nehemiah was still alive, the Navi. So, what's nice about papyrus is that paper made from Egyptian Nile reeds. And what's nice about papyrus is that papyrus can last for a very long time, as long as it's dry. And as they say, Egypt is a really, really dry place. So this piece of paper, this letter, lasted since the times of Nehemiah until today. And where was it found? This is one of the Elephantine papyri. And let's figure out why this is important. Let me just get this chair out of the way. So this is Elephantine. And Elephantine, here's Yerushalayim, this is Egypt, is at the southern border of Egypt. And at this border, which is where they found this paper, which is called the Passover Letter, at this little island called Elephantine, it sits at the bottom of the Nile River, which was called, ironically, the Upper Nile. So since the ancient times, the Egyptians, who had hundreds, if not thousands, of years of state administration bureaucracy, realized very quickly that in order to protect the country, they needed to protect the southern border from invaders. Critical to doing that is to protect the Nile River and entry into the Nile. So Elephantine is the perfect place to do that because the island is elevated and the water around it is really shallow. They go into these cataracts, which are these little rapids. And it's an extraordinarily easy position to defend because your marine, anything coming in by boat is going to be slow. You have the high ground. And so they kept, the Egyptians stationed a fort here by Elephantine. This is just the Elephantine today. At the time it was called Yeb. And here you have the fortifications overlooking the water. And they kept this fort militarized for many, many, many centuries. What's fascinating about the year 419 BCE is that instead of occupying this fort with Egyptian soldiers, they occupied it with Jewish soldiers. For some reason, there was a Jewish garrison, Jews from northern Judea, who were stationed here as mercenaries. They were paid to protect the southern Egyptian border. They were called the Elephantine Warriors. We have no idea how they got there or why, but we do know that there were Jews protecting this fort. It's almost like the like today, if you get an example, would be like the Blackwater, just the, you know, the Israeli Blackwater. So this was their job. Now, these guys were really interesting. They had their own businesses, they had their own little town, they built their own little temple, like a little Mishkan. And they left all sorts of records of their daily life, which is fascinating. They intermarried with the Egyptians. There's a lot of very interesting findings. And originally, this area was discovered to be an archaeological site in the late 1890s. And archaeologists came swimming here. The British sent a team, the French sent a team, the German sent a team. The German team is led by this Yid, this Jewish guy, Otto Rubinson. You can see him here chilling like a villain outside his tent, proudly flying the German flag in 1907, which is ironic if he knew it was coming. Lucky for him, he survived actually both wars and published a lot of material on Elephantine. So he discovered this papyrus and had it transcribed immediately because he understood its importance. Now, a lot of it is missing, but there's enough of it legible, which is written in Aramaic, to give us a good idea of what it's talking about, and that which it's talking about is Pesach. So I'm just going to read to you from what we have on this papyrus. It says, this is an order from their political liaison in Yerushalayim, who's sending them an order, or possibly a license, commands to their garrison for what they should do this Pesach. So just to give you some background, it says, to my brethren, Yedonia and his associates, the Judean garrison, your brother Hananiah. The writer is your brother Hananiah. Now the welfare of my brethren, may the gods or God shine down upon you. For the rest of this year, the fifth of Darius the king, being sent from the king Tarsames. Arsames was the, both Egypt and Eretz Yisrael were under the Persian rule at the time. So Egypt had a governor that reported to the Persians. Eretz Yisrael had a governor who reported to the Persians. Eretz Yisrael's governor was Nehemiah, and Arsames was the governor of Egypt to Persia. So he's writing on behalf of Arsames, the governor, meaning with his permission, to his friends in the garrison. Now do you count 14, probably days, and from the 15th day to the 21st day of, we're missing, be ye clean and make yourselves ready. No work, probably shall ye shall do, and something ye shall not drink. What should you not drink on Pesach? Most likely what the Egyptians beer. Drank all day, which is Egyptian beer, which is diluted water. They drink this more than water. And everything that is leaven, something you should not do until the setting of the sun, the 21st day of Nisan, take into your rooms and lock up between the days of, and then the rest is missing. So clearly this is an order from their commander, Hananiah, telling them, or possibly giving them permission to celebrate Pesach in the month of Nisan. So now, why would they have needed permission? It's quite possible that their next door neighbors, the Hanums, weren't so happy having Jewish, Jewish next door neighbors, because they used to bring korbanot in this little temple of theirs. They didn't believe in Shchutei Chutz or something, or perhaps they left before Melech Yoshia even made the cherem against Balmaz. But they would sacrifice lambs and kids and goats, and the Hanum neighbors didn't like that, and they once knocked down their temple. It wasn't a fun time. So, what do we see here? We see from this document, from the year 419 CE, we see that there's an intense interest for Jews who live outside of Eretz Yisrael to celebrate Pesach. How are they celebrating? Well, we don't see a Korban Pesach here. We see them not eating any chametz. It doesn't mention anything about matzah maror. It doesn't mention anything about Korban Pesach. But we do see that they are celebrating Pesach. This is a really long time ago, and it's fascinating. Some scholars actually believe that Hananya would be Hananya, the brother of Nehemiah, which would mean that this handwriting is the handwriting of somebody who's actually mentioned in Tanakh, which is mind-bending. Okay, so this is our earliest record. No Korban Pesach. Either he couldn't get a license for it, or he just, Hananya was from, and he didn't believe in Shchutei Chutz and doing a Korbanot outside of the Beit HaMikdash. But this is what we have. So now, we have to move on from this period to the next jump for when we have any information about how Jews celebrated the Seder or how they celebrated Pesach. Now, Olfanting, we don't see anything. We don't see a home ceremony. We don't see a Seder. We don't see liturgy. Just a tiny little clue. But we have to jump further to the Bayit Sheni, to the time of the second Beit HaMikdash. This is the first time we have any data regarding how Jews celebrated Pesach. The best data we have is obviously from the Gemara and the Mishnah. The Mishnah primarily, and the Tosefta's, which came a little earlier than the Mishnah. And we also have writings from Philo, from Josephus, from the New Testament, and we have some picture of how the Jews used to celebrate Pesach in that time. We know from Philo, from Josephus, and also from the Tosefta, that the Olim numbered in the tens of thousands. Now, this means that people made the pilgrimage from throughout Eretz Yisrael into Yerushalayim in order to shecht the Korban Pesach in Yerushalayim. They would do the shechita in here, and then they would eat it throughout the city. Now, this time is one of the most enigmatic and difficult times to understand for how Pesach exactly was practiced. Because we do have evidence that there was a form of home ceremony, and we do know that certain things did exist in this time. But let's just talk about some of the social things. First of all, you know that the city must have been jam-packed and full. We know that in the New Testament, this is famous, Yeshu sent his disciples to go reserve him a room in Yerushalayim because he, it's like Meron, you know, he just needed a place to stay for the Beit HaMikdash, for the Korban Pesach. He needed a place to stay, so he sent people ahead to get him an apartment before he went. Choni HaMagel says, but before it was going to rain, he told everybody to bring in their ovens for the Korban Pesach, which means that in Yerushalayim, besides having thousands of olim, you also had ovens everywhere because people were going to roast their Korban Pesach. So it definitely did exist. So in order to get the rest of the information we need about all the halachot and how they practiced it, we have to look to the Gemara, to the Mishnah and Psachim in the 10th parak. So let me just explain a little bit about Masechet Psachim for those who don't know. This is the Bamberg edition of Shas, which is printed in around 1519. The Bamberg edition of Shas doesn't call it Masechet Pesachim, it calls it Masechtot Pesach Rishon V'Sheini, because it was originally two volumes. The first volume was Perek Aleph through Dalet, which deals with the non-Korban Pesach stuff like Bedikat Chametz, Biur Chametz, Afiat Matzah, etc. The next Perakim, from Hey all the way to Tet, those deal with all the halachot of Korban Pesach, Korban Sheini, Pesach Sheini, etc. Tuma V'Tahara. So, originally, Psachim was divided into two volumes. One was Aleph and Dalet and Yud, the other was Hei through Tes. This was Psachim Pesach Rishon. This is just a folio of Arbeit Psachim, but I don't have the actual first page, but that's what it said in the beginning of the Sefer. Now, as far as we can tell, Masechet Pesachim's 10th parak, which describes the halachic skeleton of the Seder, as far as we could tell, that part probably post-dates the Korban, and that part was probably added to the Mishnayot later, which is why it would be the 10th parak and not the 5th parak, so to speak. And in this parak, it tells us a whole lot about the Seder, and some of it comes from before the Korban, some of it comes from after the Korban. We know for sure that there were elements like the Kiddush, we know that there was Birkat HaMazon at that time, we know for sure there was Korban, Matzah, Maror, and Charoset. That we all know for sure regarding the time of the Bayit Sheni. But deciphering exactly how things worked is very, very difficult. Just here's an example, some of these Mishnayot, right? We have Mazgulo Kos Rishon, the very famous Bechami Omri B'Merechal Yom, V'Hakam V'Merechal Yayin, V'Heviyu L'Fan of Mitabel B'Chazer, Dachem Agil, Prepare Tapat, and Mazgulo Kos Sheni, V'Kana Ben Shoel, V'im In Datu Ben, Avim Alam Do, right? Ma Nishtan Alay Lazet. So this deciphering these Mishnayot and the Tosefas that are related to them is the best information we have to try to reverse engineer exactly how they did the Seder in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. So, how did this research begin? Let's start with the grandfathers of all this. You have Rabbi Professor Daniel Goldschmidt here on the left. He was the probably the most prominent historian and scholar of Jewish liturgy in his time. He wrote a Haggadah Shel Pesach in Berlin before the war. He wrote it in German. Then after the war, he was prompted by Mossad Bialik to update it and to put it out in Hebrew. And he did the first excellent, real scholarly review of the Pesach Seder and of the Haggadah. So what he discovered, which was quite obvious to anyone working in the field at the time, would have been that the Pesach Haggadah never had a single author. The Pesach Haggadah was written and evolved over a series of generations, just like the Siddur. And he did a great job of dissecting the Haggadah from the Amoraic period, from the time of the Amoraim and onwards. And he showed very well how many Midrashim were influenced by the Gemara, and which ones developed when, what parts of the Haggadah developed at which times, and he did a terrific, this is still a classic, he did a terrific job in this Haggadah Shel Pesach of covering most major elements of the Haggadah, and especially of Mishnayot, doing a very good job in reconstructing the basic outline of the history. The next, we have a Menachem Mendel Kasher, famous for his Torah Shlema. He wrote the Haggadah Shlema, which is an exhaustive review, really exhaustive, where he goes through a tremendous amount of text and he does a cross-comparison of different texts in order to come away with a better understanding. By comparing Nuskaot, he comes away with a much better understanding of the development of the Haggadah in the medieval time and in the early medieval time. So it's an essential work. You can still get this in Zimbel Berman. The other one you can get in Mossad Bialik. So now, as time progressed, more Haggadahs were published. So this was published maybe in the 60s, this one maybe in the late 50s. But as time progressed, Daniel Goldschmidt's, Rabbi Professor Daniel Goldschmidt's, and Menachem Mendel Kasher's Haggadahs got a little bit out of date. So in the late 90s, in the early 2000s, the Safrai family, with all these pictures, the photographers did a great job of hiding their kippot. So you have... what's the word? This is Shmuel Safrai and his son Zev Safrai published the Haggadat Chazal. This is an extraordinarily important work. This is Yosef Tabori, also a Dati Lumi rabbi. He published this book, Pesach Dorot, and this JPS commentary on the Haggadah. What these scholars did, albeit with a little bit less of respect for Chazal than the previous scholars had, they went through the Mishnayot using the most up-to-date manuscripts, the most up-to-date information we have regarding the development of the Haggadah, especially with the Tosefta and related texts. They used the latest information possible to get a much better idea of what the Seder looked like and what the development of the Seder looked like in the first century, right before, right after the Churban HaBayit. Their two main takeaways were the following. Very simple. The Haggadah, at least the part about it, which is an agadata or a drush, was most likely, even the halachic structure of the Haggadah, besides the agadic part about it, was developed by the Chachmei Yavne. The Chachmei Yavne, of course, with the Begum Liel Sheni, You have Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah, the famous Tanaim who made up the Chachmei. They were the ones similar to the Sidur who constructed the Seder as we know it. And honestly, most of the Tanaim mentioned in Perek Yud are from that group. The second thing they discovered was that most likely there was no Magid, there was no Agadata in the Seder during that time. During the time of the Beit HaMikdash, they did not have a Magid section. They had a Korban Pesach, they did not have a Magid section as we know it today during the Seder. Now there's halachic implications to that, because anybody who's smart would know that there's a mitzvah regarding Halabin Chabayomahu. So how exactly were they Makayim that? Some would say it would be the Hallel. Some would say it would have been some other way. They would have just made it up ad lib as they went. But for the most part, this does seem to be correct, that there was no official fixed text for anything similar to a Magid. So now let's move forward another almost 20 years. And this is in 2016, I believe. Also, I should mention that the idea of the Gadat al-Bincha is a mitzvah only on the night of Pesach is only Shitat HaRambam, based on one Mechilta, which is brought in the Haggadah. The Rush doesn't agree, and there's other solutions for that halachically. Okay, let's fast forward 16 years. This is the Haggadah Manishtana, published by Rabbi Professor David Henschke. He has clean shaven, but he's a tremendous Tamil Chacham, and he knows his business. And he used all the work that Zafrai and Tabori did, and spent quite a bit of time exhaustively going through the Haggadah and coming away with even more conclusions. And his were very, very, his conclusions were very, very, very interesting. And at this point, his Haggadah is the new shiny thing in the world of Haggadah scholarship, and everybody has to respond to him because he did probably the best work when it comes to dissecting the Haggadah. So let's just talk about his conclusions very quickly. So if you look at the Mishnah very quickly, it says that they would, after the Kiddush, they would bring in front of him a Tavel b'chazeret, they would dip the Ash Megillah prepared the pas, this is the karpas part, and then a few lefanav, they would bring the table with matzah, chazeret, charoset, u'shnei tavshilim, af pishen charoset mitzvah, and then matzgulo kosheni, v'kana ben shoel, right? So first they bring out all the food, they pour the cup of wine, and then they begin the magid. So, if you think about it, let's ask the basic question, why are you bringing out all the food, why are you bringing out the matzah maror and the wine, if you're not going to eat it right now? So what's the whole point of that? The obvious answer would be, what do you mean? You have to say magid. You have to say matzah, zel, shuma, you have to say all that. But if you think about it, this part of the Mishnah was written before the Churban, and there was no magid. So if there was no magid, why in the world were they bringing out all the food if they were going to eat it right away? So, and furthermore, if the whole point was to do the agadata, then why in the world would they be pouring the wine? The wine doesn't have a matzah shuma. The wine is not mentioned in the magid portion. So why bring out all the food if you have no purpose for it? So Henschke proposes as following. We know that by the mitzvah of lulav and etrog, it's to unah halel, right? It requires halachically that we say halel with it. When you do the shechitat korban pesach, you have to say halel. We know also that when you eat the korban pesach, you have to say halel. But when you're shaking the lulav and etrog, that's very obvious that you could talk while shaking. If you're shefting, you could have the levim singing while you're shefting. But when you're eating, you cannot eat while singing halel. So what must they have done? What Henschke proposes is that they would sandwich the Hallel into the Seudah. Into the Seudah. First they would bring out the Korban Pesach, they would bring out the food, bring out the matzah, they would begin Hallel, then they would eat the Korban Pesach, and then they would finish Hallel. This is why in the Haggadah Shel Pesach, they split the Hallel. This is why we start the Hallel, say the Berkat HaGeula, do the meal, and then finish Hallel. Because originally the Hallel was the emphasis and the focus of the night ceremony, of the Seder, during the Bayit Sheni. And originally people thought that perhaps the solution was that they would eat right away here in this Mishnah, but this was disproven from a Tosefta that they later found. It did not make any sense that they would eat right away. No, they did not eat right away. So his idea is that the Hallel was the original focus of the Seder in the time of the Bayit Sheni. And after the destruction of Ben Gamliel and the Chachmei Yavne had to replace the Korban Pesach with something, and that was the mitzvah of Magid. And there was an expression that the Gemara mentions that went around during the time of the Bayit Sheni, Kizeta Pischa Behalela Paka Igara. The expression was that sometimes the groups that would participate in the Korban Pesach were so big that everybody would only get a kizayit of the roasted lamb, but there were so many people on the roof, halila, the halal they would sing, would break the roofs. Meaning that the halal was the core, and the singing of the halal was the core emphasis of the Haggadah, of the Seder in their time. Okay, so now once this timeline was established, this led scholars to assume many other facts about the Seder and to try to extrapolate many other facts about the timeline for how the Seder developed. The first is, this is one which is very contentious, the first fact that they try to determine about the Haggadah and or the Magid and the nature of the Seder is that it's very anti-Christian. Why is it anti-Christian? Because Rabbi Gamliel at that time was a famous fighter of the Christians, and the Christians also were starting to celebrate their own form of Seder Pesach, and therefore it must be that the Haggadah, because it's from that time, contains many anti-Christian things. So we know, for example, that the Christians at this time would have what they called an agape feast, right? So this is just from the second century in Rome, in the Catacomb of Priscilla. This is called the fresco for Theopanis, the breaking of the bread. In their time, they used to do, at least for sure, the Quartodecimans, they did the Easter, they celebrated Easter on Pesach, the Dafka, and they had their own Passover-type feast, which was the predecessor to the Eucharist. They had fish, you could see them holding the matzah, and they had themselves the wine. So what Rabbi Gamliel is doing, according to these scholars, is he's saying, why do we say Pesach al Shuma? Why do we say Matz al Shuma and Maror al Shuma? We say these things in order to contradict the way the Christians did it. Yet another theory is that Dayenu is like a hymn, which is a retort to a similar hymn that they have in their Eucharist things from Leto Sardis, which says that the Jews were an ungrateful nation. So Dayenu is a response to that poem. It's possible, some feel, I always lean that, I didn't really like this theory that it's an anti-Christian, that the Haggadah is an anti-Christian text. I never really see the rayas. And also, if we're speaking honestly, it takes a lifetime to become a specialist in Jewish liturgy and Jewish history, and it takes a lifetime to become a specialist in Christian liturgy and Christian history. We've never found someone who is both. So to make these comparisons, you're always talking to somebody who's a chatzi expert in both, and therefore they're never really convincing arguments. So I haven't seen it. Some people have pushed the theory very hard that the Haggadah is very much an anti-Christian response. I really don't see it, and most scholars don't see it, especially because, according to them, Rabbi Gamliel, the Christians weren't a real threat to the Rabbanis at the time. The Rabbanis, they had a lot of sects to deal with. Christianity wasn't a special one to them. For them, the Roman Empire was a much bigger problem than a small Christian sect. We don't have any positive evidence that the Christians were a real problem for Gamliel enough to make a whole polemical text or ceremony around that. Okay, the next part, which is important, the next product of isolating the Seder to that time period would be relating it to the Roman Convivium. So we know, as Rava says, that many aspects of the Seder are intended so that we should act b'derech chirut, right? Act like we're free. Freemen. Freemen at the time meant that you were an elitist, you were an aristocrat. The Greco-Roman meals had a completely different banquet style than we would consider today. And I should point out that I'm going to be a little pedantic, but most people will say that the Seder resembles a Greek symposium. The Greek symposium was an earlier form of banquet, which was much more centered around drinking. The Roman Convivium was their style of banquet at the time, which was more centered around eating. So just to give you some background, the Rishonim say, like the Ravian or Ravan, that many features of the Seder, like Haseba, were only mandatory or chiyuvi because in their time, that's how people would, the elite would dine. But if we don't do this bisman azef, in your time, that's not what elitist people do. It's not me'akev. We don't paskin like that, l'chatchila, but this is one of the shishkal rishonim. Now, black and white in the Roman times, only the elite reclined. And I just have to explain to you exactly how their meals went. So if you think about a Jewish banquet today, whether it's a wedding, a dinner, or something, you're going to come into the place and you're going to see what you might consider a Jewish affair, but it really is a Judaicized Western banquet. You walk into a wedding, there's going to be the smorgasbord and the music and the first course and the second course and the dancing and then the chuppah. Or if you're at a dinner, you're going to have the schedule. And even if you weren't Jewish, you basically get the idea. You know, you basically understand what's happening even at a Jewish wedding or at a Jewish dinner. Same thing is true in the times of the Jews of Rome. Most of the Jewish banquets were Judaicized forms of the Roman convivium, especially if you were in the elite class. We have a buffet, we have an explicit Tosefta which says Ketzad Seder Hasuda, Ketzad Seder Hamsubim. It tells you exactly how people would conduct themselves, or at least elite people would conduct themselves during a formal banquet. So this is just one example. There are centuries of Roman rules, so we can't go through all the examples. But this is a triclinium, right? This is known in the Mishnah as a traclin. Tri means three. Klein is from clinium, is from the couches, right? Recline. So these are the three-couch room. And as you can see, you have the mazgulo, the hevil, the funav, the servants bringing the food to the center table, and you have everybody reclining and taking from that table. They were also very classist, the Romans, and the Jews were as well. Yeah, the Romans were kind of classist, so were the Jews. And basically, where you sat really determined your social status. If you were, you know, smack in the center, you were the most chashuv on the right side, second to most chashuv. It was a whole situation. If you look in the Tosefta, the Jews had their own way of doing it as well. There were couches that were higher, couches that were lower. But this was how the Jews did their banquets, which were supposed to be aristocratic. And the idea was that Rabbi Gamliel wanted to make a seder, or a halachic construct where everybody would feel like they were freemen, everybody would feel like they were aristocrats. Okay, so from here, whose couch is this? This is the couch of Lucius Verus, the emperor of Rome. This is in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. If you want to go to Manhattan and see this, they reconstructed it from the little pieces they found in his palace, and they put back together his couch. If anybody wants to be Mekayim, you know, the Mahadrim, you could go to the Met, steal the couch, have an interesting Pesach, but you'll be Mekayim, the mitzvah of Hesedah exactly. Because this, you know, the king would have his own couch. He wasn't going to sit with the peasants and the worms. You know, he was gonna have his own dedicated couch where he lay on. Anyway, this explains a lot of things. First of all, the gustadio, which is the appetizer. So when they would come in, the guests first over here, there would be a first room where they would come and have appetizers, and they would dip vegetables into schug or into hummus. This is what the Mishnah means by mitabel de chazeret. They would dip vegetables into other vegetables. That was the appetizer. And then after the appetizers, they'd move everybody into the main room. Some say this is also why the four cups of wine were instituted. Because Greco-Roman symposiums would have a lot of drinking or scheduled drinking. But this, although this was an early theory, it didn't really pan out because, honestly, there's no parallel to this. There's no parallel in the Greek or Roman meals to have four scheduled cups of wine. So it doesn't seem to be a very good theory. More likely, the four cups of wine are simply there for the mitzvot. And as far as we can tell, that's their function. You have Kiddush, Berkat HaMazon, Berkat HaGeula, and Berkat HaHalel at the end. So it does not seem like the four cups of wine have anything to do with Greco-Roman influences. It's much more that the four cups of wine are there for Derech Heirut, then they got attached to the mitzvot, the Kiddush and Berkat HaMazon, and then finally they got the Drashot that represented all four cups of wine. That's at least the historical lean for how that developed. Now, this is so nice. We have some skeletal understanding of what the Seder looked like in the Second Temple period, but what would life have been like if you weren't in Yerushalayim? What if you were a Jew living in Babel or in Egypt? What in the world, how did you celebrate Pesach? And we don't really have any good data about that. We don't have any solid information for what they would do. If they're not being Olal Regal, how would people feel? Well, we don't have Korban Pesach to bring. So exactly what are we going to do? which is going to make us feel like we are being mekayem Pesach. So, for this, we have to turn to the Mishnah in Pesachim, Daf Nun Gimel Amud Aleph. And let's just start here. Makom shenagu le'chol tzali b'lele Pesachim ochlin. Makom shenagu shelo le'chol en ochlin. Right? This is taloy minhag makom. There was a minhag, says the Mishnah, that some people would eat a roasted kid on the night of Pesach. This is after the Korban. Zecher the Korban Pesach. In a place where they have a minhag, they could do it. In a place where they don't have that minhag, they can't do it. Says the Gemara Rabbi Yossi, Todos ish Romi, hini get b'nei Romi le'chol gedi'im mekulasim b'lele Pesachim. The Todos of Rome, the leader of the Jews of Rome, he instructed the Jews of Rome to eat gedi'im mekulasim, which means basically a goat with its folded up like it's being roasted, b'lele Pesachim, and the Chachamim were upset with him. Shalchulo imalei Todos ata. If you weren't Todos, and the Tosef Sefta says that if you weren't the Parnasan Shel Chachamim, the supporter of the rabbis, then Gezano alechem yidui. If you weren't Todos, you weren't Chashuv, we would put you in Cherem. Why shatam achil itzel kachim bachutz? Because, and the Gemara explains, that you're making people think that they're eating kachim outside of the boundaries of Yerushalayim. And in the another Tosefta, it says that people used to call it Pesach. And the Chachamim got upset that people were confusing this Gedim Kulasim for the Korban Pesach. So now we don't know exactly when Todos Yishrami lived. Did he live before the Korban? In which case it was a real problem of Shchut Echutz, or at least it would be Marit Ayin, or did he live right after the Korban? And why were the rabbis upset at him to begin with? We know that the Mishnah Paskins you're allowed to. And it also, we know from two other Mishnayot, we know that the Rabbi Gamliel endorsed it explicitly. Rabbi Gamliel totally endorsed this minhag, so it's not clear exactly why. It's a fascinating rabbit hole as to like which Rabbi Gamliel this was. We don't know why the Chachamim got upset about this. Now, regarding Todos Yishrami, can we identify him to find the time? What we could find is, we know that the Jews did live in Rome. These are the catacombs of Rome. The Jews had their own civilization in Rome since before the Korban, but even after the Korban, when many Jewish slaves were brought to Rome, they used to bury their dead in catacombs, and they have all sorts of inscriptions, so we know that there was a Jewish presence in Rome. Todos Yishrami was a back-and-forth kind of dignitary who led the Jews in Rome. And then another clue is this. This is called the Theodotus inscription. They found this in 1913 on the outskirts of Yerushalayim. They were excavating a cistern, there was an abandoned construction site, and they found a plaque from a shul. Incidentally, this is the oldest record we have of the existence of a shul. Let me just read you what it says. Theodotus, son of Bethanus, priest and head of synagogue, son of the head of the synagogue, and grandson of the head of the synagogue, built the synagogue for the reading of the law and for the teaching of its commandments, as well as a guest room, the chambers, and the water fittings as an inn for those in the need from abroad, the synagogue which his fathers founded with the elders and the Simonides. So, basically, this Theodotus guy, his grandfathers and great-grandfathers already built a shul, and this plaque is from the early first century. So we have from the maybe 20, year 25, year 30, we can already see that shuls existed for a long time. But a lot of people assume that Todos Yishrami would be this Theodotus, son of Bethanus, who apparently was a chashuv guy before the Korban, which would place his detractors as the Chachamim before Rabbi Gamliel d'Yavne. Okay, this is actually an image of geniuses trying to do Korban Pesach today. What we see from this story in the Gemara is that Jews outside of Eretz Yisrael, far away from Eretz Yisrael, still were intensely interested in keeping Pesach without the Korban Pesach and doing some sort of Seder-type ceremony on their own. We don't see Dalet Kosot, we don't see any of the Manishtana, any of those halachot yet at this time. Now, when I started studying this and I realized that this was a minhag that once happened, that people would do a pseudo-roasted Korban Pesach, I thought to myself, okay, makom shenagu lechol, okay, this is from the time of Mishnah. There's no way that anybody ever continued to do a minhag like this. That's insane. To do a fake Korban Pesach, especially the Chachamim were upset. There's no way such a thing continued. But that's not true. There's two Toseftas, at least, which record this practice as continuing. We see one of them is with Pinchas ben Yair from the 3rd century. So we know that at least 200 years later, after Todos, people were still doing this. Fast forward 200 years to the year 407, and we have a letter between two church fathers, Jerome and Augustine, and Jerome is advising Augustine about his new Jewish converts who just converted to Christianity, and he was complaining to him that they were still doing all their Jewish things like Brit Milah and Shabbat and on Pesach. They're still roasting their kid, so in their goat. So we see already in the year 407, Jews were still doing this, at least in Eretz Yisrael. You fast forward another 200 years to the 600s and 700s. There are these two texts from the Yeshivot of Eretz Yisrael called Sefer Masim of Eretz Yisrael, Me'ot Chinuf HaMenhagim. Not really, they're from the Gaonic era, very early halachic svarim. And the manuscripts, the remnants we have of these svarim contain references to this minhag in the 6th and 7th centuries. Fast forward another 200 years, and you have in the Cairo Geniza at least 40 documents which represent the Eretz Yisrael Nusach of the Haggadah. With this fascinating extra bracha, you can read here, Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher Tziva, Tzivanu B'Tzivat Avotenu, B'Mitzrayim, Le'echol, Matzot Morim, B'Sar Tzli Esh. They had their own bracha in Eretz Yisrael, where they kept this minhag. They had their own bracha in order to eat the Gedimi Kulas, or the Tzali, as they called it. And this guy wasn't a good Talmid Chacham, but in other manuscripts we have better versions of it. He also adds the bracha of Zohar Brit, etc. These are brachot that we don't actually have. So now that we've gotten to the Gaonic era, right, we have an entire area of time where we don't actually know precisely how the Seder was developing. Again, I would recommend a look at Goldschmidt's work, but during the Gaonic era, understanding the Seder or the Haggadah takes quite a bit of work. First, let's start with when the liturgy began to get fixed. So we know from the Gemara refers to a specific Agadita that they would say, at least in the time of the Amoraim, from the 3rd century. So this shows, as academics like to call it, an early trend towards fixity. That unlike many other forms of liturgy, the Haggadah saw an early trend where people were trying to make a fixed nusach for what the Haggadah should be. And this is a very remarkable thing, which we don't typically see with liturgy. We also see in the time of the Gaonim, at least from, let's say, from the year, from after the Amoraim, the 400s all the way to, let's say, the 900s, we see during this period two minhagim crop up. There's the Talmud Yerushalmi, right, the Minhag Eretz Yisrael, and the Talmud HaBavli, the Minhag of the Yeshivot of Bavel, and the major Gaonim there. And these developed into two distinct Nusaot. A minority of people in Cairo, maybe 10% of them, followed the Minhag of Talmud HaYerushalmi, and therefore in the Cairo Geniza, we have about a 10% ratio of manuscripts from the Kahal in Cairo, which kept the Minhag Talmud HaYerushalmi. So they also have in the Talmud HaYerushalmi their own Nuscha'ot, like Baruch Sha'asani Sim. They would only say Mitzchila instead of Avedim Hayinu. They would have the Kiddush HaAroch. They do separate brachot for Netilah. There was a Chisat Yedayim, Netilah Yedayim, Shtivat Yedayim. Very interesting. If anybody's interested in an analysis of that, look in the Haggadat Chazal of Safrai. They do an excellent analysis. What's interesting about comparing both, obviously, is when you compare both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, you see which elements are identical, and that shows you what the earliest fixed form was. When you see the components in each which are identical, you can match them up and see what the earlier form was in the time of the early Amoraim. Okay, so the Gaonim rejected the Nusach HaYerushalmi. This is manuscript Halper 216, if anybody's interested. They rejected it. There's a Tshuvah from Rabbi Natshonai Gaon, where he thinks someone sent him a question regarding that Nusach, and he says it must be Karaim. You know, anybody who uses this Nusach must be, put in Nidoi. He very clearly rejects it, and that Nusach saw its demise with the ascendancy of the Yeshivot of Bavel. Their Nusach took dominance, and the Nusach of Eretz Yisrael basically went extinct. And also the Nusach HaBavli was much more consolidated. Nusach Eretz Yisrael was never really consolidated into one fixed Nusach. Now, why don't we have any Haggadot from this period, from the time from, let's say, 400 all the way to the year 900? This is because of a halacha in the Gemara on Shabbat called Kotvei Brachot Kisorfei Torah. Gemara on Shabbat at the end. The Gemara on Shabbat basically says that a person who writes down the brachot is like he's burning Torah. Why? Because of a technical reason, you're not allowed to save brachot from a fire on Shabbat. So if somebody's writing down a sidur, writing down brachot, it's like they're already burnt. So this pseudo ban remained in effect for a long time, and people would only write down brachot if it was strictly necessary, or if they were writing it down in the context of halacha. So here you see this is called a rotulus. This is like a manuscript or someone's supposed to roll up like a mezuzah. And people would write Haggadot for themselves, for their own use at the Seder. They just needed it. They couldn't remember the entire Nusach by heart. So people would write it, and they would throw it out at the end of Pesach. Also, you had a lot of people, you know, you had your wife, everybody was participating in the Seder. It was very difficult not to have some sort of text. Now, the next form of having a Haggadah came in the form of Svarim of Halacha and in Machzorim. So you have the Seder of Amram Gaon, the Seder of Sadia Gaon, which are and the Machzor Vitri, which are halachic works, which categorize and basically lay out the format for how tefillah should look. And in those Halacha, Svarim is our first and earliest, almost complete forms of the Haggadah, as well as in the Ginzei Shechter, there's another Haggadah there as well. There's a group called the Scribes of the Cairo Geniza, which is like an open source project. And this group together finds all the images in the Cairo Geniza, and they classify and categorize them, and they found even more Haggadot in recent history. So this one here is from France, from the 12th century. This is one of the earliest manuscripts of a Haggadah, and this is from within a French Machzor. So this, after this short era of about 100, 200 years, when Haggadot only existed in Machzorim, during the first, spread of Sidurim, which were outside of the Halacha Sefer, we have rich people, being rich people, who wanted a fancy, independent Haggadah all for themselves, not satisfied with the Machzor. They wanted a separate volume, which was for their Haggadah table, which was just going to be a Haggadah. So, if you look here, this is called the Prato Haggadah. It's from Spain in the early 1300s. What's nice about this is that I get to show you exactly how they were made. So you would need four people to make one of these Haggadot. You would need a patron, a guy who's going to bankroll it. You would need the artist, you would need a scribe, and you would need the rabbi to approve it. So you can see here exactly how they made it. They would start with the paper, they'd go from the least expensive to the most expensive components, and then the artist would go and sketch it on the paper. Then you have the scribe who would put in his words, right? Finally, the artist would start layering down the inks in order of expense. This orange stuff here, you see how this gold looks a little bit raised? This orange stuff is called bol, and on the fancier inks, which were supposed to raise up from the paper, they would put bol to raise it up. So this was very fancy, very expensive stuff. It would cost tens of thousands of dollars to do in today's money, but rich people don't care. Now, fast forward a little bit, in a few decades, and you have absolutely stunning pieces of art, which are much more interesting to the students of art, but here we are, and this is actually kind of nice. My favorite here is there's many, many Haggadot from this period, but this is the Barcelona Haggadah, and you can see again the gold and the fancy colors. You could buy a facsimile of this, which a facsimile is like a fancy real reproduction by artists. I think the British Museum owns this manuscript, so we'll sell you a facsimile for only 3,500 Great British Pounds to buy it for someone you love. And a lot of this artwork is really fun, all depicting different biblical scenes. Lots and lots of fun. Well, we're just going to go through a few famous ones. The next is the Bird's Head Haggadah. This one is very strange, where all the all the characters or the miniatures and the icons in it of people, they're human bodies, but they have bird heads. Don't know why. Nobody knows why. It could be that either the rabbi or the priest in the town wouldn't allow iconography, or the artist was just tripping on something, but we're not clear. Regardless, this artist decided to make everybody with a bird's head, and it's fascinated students of art until this day. and they love it, and nobody has any idea what's going on. This is a woman. She's rolling the matzah. That's the rabbi, and this is the guy poking the matzah to put holes in it. Good times. Really, really good times. It's weird. You can buy a facsimile for much less money, but the Birds Head Haggadah is very strange and great to people who study art. This is the Sarajevo Haggadah. This is, again, world famous, not just for how much it's worth, but also it's worth that much because of its story. The Sarajevo Haggadah was, I think it's from the late 1300s, or maybe, no, 1340, I think it was created for a wealthy family. In the 1800s, it was owned by a wealthy family, I think it was the Cohen family, who fell on hard times. And as the story goes, their son brought the Haggadah to school to sell it and to get the family money. And then the teachers realized something was wrong, so they brought in a museum curator who paid the family 150 crowns for this Haggadah. Now, what's fascinating about the museum in Bosnia, which bought this Haggadah, is that the museum staff, the curators, the police force in Sarajevo, and an imam, a sheikh, a priest, many, many people were involved in saving this Haggadah. They literally risked their lives to protect this Haggadah during the First World War, during the Second World War, during the Bosnian Revolution and the Siege of Sarajevo. People literally risked their lives to keep this Haggadah alive and to keep it safe. So today, all that cloak and dagger stuff, you know, has made people very fascinated by it. They tried making a movie about it. They wrote a book about it. It has a fascinating life story. It's probably worth like $30 million. And if you want to go see it, you're going to have to take a plane trip to Bosnia, where it is now like a national treasure. This one here is the Darmstadt Haggadah, just to give you an example of a Haggadah made not in Spain, but in Germany, I believe. I think this is a German Haggadah. I don't know how the artwork precisely is different. It clearly is, to my eyes, different, but it's just slightly different influences, and I don't really know exactly how to categorize them. I would sound smart if I do, but I'm not a student of art at all. Let's move a little bit forward to the era of the printing press. So a lot of people have this misconception about the era of the printing press, that as soon as the printing press showed up, paper and documents became free and so much cheaper, and everybody suddenly was able to afford books, and it changed the world in one night. It's not exactly how it worked. The printing press, at least the early technologies, were primitive, and they slowly, slowly got better. However, printed books were very, very expensive, and to get your hands on one would require, even to print one would require a lot of volume, a lot of scale. They had to plan it economically in advance. And so printed books were quite expensive. Even if you were Jewish, you wanted a chumash, a siddur, it could cost you a lot of money to get one of these books. But the printers saw a tremendous economic opportunity in smaller books, like the Tikkuni Shabbat or the Haggadah Shel Pesach, because it's only 20 pages. At the end of the day, it's not a tome like a chumash or a siddur, it's 20 pages. So even a middle-class family could afford one of these. And if even a middle-class family could afford a 20-page Haggadah, and spoiler alert, there's not many changes in the Nusach between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim, they stood to make a whole lot of money from the printing Haggadahs for families. And they did. This is the earliest printed Haggadah that we know of, from Guadalajara in Spain, from 1482. No illustrations, nothing. Is very primitive, right? This is the primitive printing technology. And then it's right before the expulsion. And then 1486 in Italy, you have the Sansino family, also making a sidurello, a really small Haggadah. These are very primitive templates, which they would use. These are woodcuts. And this is, again, one of the earliest printed Haggadot. Very valuable if you get a copy today. As time progressed, you have Haggadot made with much more elaborate illustrations. These are woodcuts, if anybody knows how to tell, from the grain of the stamp. These are woodcut. I think this one is this the Amsterdam? No, this is not the Amsterdam. This is the Prague Haggadah, a very famous Haggadah that people like the illustrations to and got reused for a very long time. You fast forward to the 1600s, and the technology gets even better with copper plating, and a lot of the artwork gets even much more detailed. This is the Amsterdam Haggadah. It was imitated a million times. They repurposed all the templates from it a trillion times. And I love how some of the artwork tells you about how people used to think in the days. This is the Chachamim in Bnei Brak celebrating in a palace that looks like Versailles. Go figure. Here you have a Chacham, Rasha, Tam, and She'en Yodea Lishol.
they would have like stamps in the print house. So if they found one that looked like a rasha, here over here they decided that a soldier was the worst possible thing that you could be in the 1600s. That was the epitome of evil, was a soldier. So that's the guy who ends up in the Haggadah as the rasha. Very fun. Okay, so now throughout the modern period, as the Haggadot are getting developed, we have hundreds and hundreds of Haggadot coming out. So it's not just due to the printing press, but also due to the commentaries and to the artwork and to the needs of every community who wanted their version of Birkat HaMazon, their version of the slight differences in the halachot. But as printing became much more cheap and more ubiquitous, we have hundreds and hundreds of Haggadot. By 1961, Professor Avraham Yari did a survey of all the extant Haggadot, and this is only 400 years since the advent of printing. He counted 2,717 Haggadot known to him. Since then, the number has probably doubled, and this is called the Otzer Haggadot. It's an updated version of Avraham Yari's Thesaurus of the Otzer Haggadah. And if you look today, this is literally an image from eBay. If you just search on eBay collection of Haggadot, you can buy them in the dozens. People have all sorts of Haggadot, every Jewish denomination, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, you name it. Everybody who has ever been anyone has decided to make a Haggadah. So the obvious question is why? Why of all Jewish texts has the Haggadah received so much attention? And we're almost done here. So the most obvious would be, well, because it's cheap and it's a small book. So, why not make every version for your own, to your own liking? But if you were to actually do the work, you would have to go through hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of Haggadot to really get a sense of why is it that people thought it was so important to make their own Haggadot and have their own spins on it and to make their own hybrids and their own versions. So someone did it. Her name was Mesa Ox. And you don't have to agree with her conclusions, but it's worth listening. She comes away with three ideas. The first idea is that because the Haggadah Shel Pesach, or the Seder of the Haggadah Shel Pesach, was originally instituted around the Korban Pesach, without the Korban Pesach, the Seder is by nature an imperfect meal. It's by nature an imperfect ceremony. So just because the entire Seder is constructed, and the halachic construct of the Seder is constructed around this imperfection, people saw this as license to add their own takes on things, to add their own agadah, to add their own ways of doing it. Her next idea was, because the Seder, the Haggadah Shel Pesach, doesn't have a linear message. It wasn't written by a single redactor with intentionality of a single redactor. It has different periods where different parts got added. Some of the parts were juxtaposed intentionally, some were not. And you have questions without answers, you have answers without questions, you have agadot from Pesukim that are easily understood, agadot from Pesukim which are not easily understood. It's much more geared towards the prepared, much more geared towards people who are erudite, and therefore, because it doesn't have a clear linear message, it's so much easier for somebody to come in and say, let me paint my own message, let me paint my own way of commenting on the Haggadah or presenting the Haggadah. And the last idea she has is that the Haggadah doesn't address the elephant in the room. The subtext of the Haggadah Shel Pesach is always a subtext of optimism. And that is that when we are in trouble, when we're in bad times, if we cry out to Hashem, you have an evil king, he's going to come and kill you all. Cry out to Hashem, he's going to save you. Right? Every generation, people try to destroy us. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzileinu Mi'adam, and Hashem saves us. This subtext, or this idea of optimism, never addresses the elephant in the room, which is that Jews of the modern period never experienced that. That wasn't true. They didn't experience that. For them, they had plenty of instances where, for the most notable example, this is the Holocaust. There was an evil king who said he was going to kill all the Jews, and he went ahead and killed all the Jews. He literally did that, and he got away with it. So for many Jews who were living this awful experience of exile, they didn't feel this optimism that the Haggadah set to express. They didn't feel the safety, the salvation that comes along with the message here. They didn't feel that chayrut. And therefore, for many people, the Haggadah was a little bit, they felt sometimes bitter about the messages of the Haggadah and sought to almost reply or respond. And she gives an amazing example. This example here is a Haggadah published for one Seder ever in history. this is the Seder which happened in the DP camp in Munich for the Dachau prisoners after the Holocaust. You could see here, this is, he called it, the writer, Yosef Scheinzen, Musaf l'Haggadah Shal Pesach. He didn't want to call it Haggadah, he called it an addendum to the Haggadah Shal Pesach. And the story is like this. The rabbi of the concentration camp, well, the DP camp, I should say, his name was Rabbi Abraham Klausner, a reform rabbi, really was Meister Nefesh for the Jews, the 32,000 survivors of Dachau. And, yeah, here's a picture of him at, I think, at the Seder. So basically, he was really Meister Nefesh for the people, and morale was not high. Morale at this, after the war, people... I mean, he was very thankful to the Third Army. This is the symbol of the Third Army for rescuing the Jews of Dachau. The people were not. The Third Army basically neglected them. Most of these people had just walked out of hell. And so, from his perspective, if they wanted to make their own Haggadah and express themselves, he wanted them to do it. It's a fascinating story in 1946 when he rented out the Munich Theater restaurants for 200 people and did a Haggadah, for a Seder for anybody who was interested. I'm surprised Mishpacha magazine hasn't done a story about this yet, but it was a very, very moving Seder. When they reached the Manishtana, they realized that there were no young children to say the Manishtana, and it was so strange. People started weeping and crying. That was such an unnatural, strange thing to experience, to be at a Seder with no young children to say Manishtana. So this was a very moving, very... scary Seder. Anyways, you could see in this Haggadah, this is a Haggadah of sacrilege and an indictment against God. First, you have here the Beholah Hitler. There's a lot of things where he replaces power with Hitler, etc. But the artwork that Scheinzen put in is barbed wire everywhere, reminiscent of the concentration camps. Here you see the gates. Here you have them working like an image straight out of hell. And then you have the right and the left and the Shapar lo gazar ela zacharim v'lavan bikesh la'akor et hakol. You have this image of the Nazis. What I found most interesting about this Haggadah is the absolutely sacrilegious Dayenu, which is incredible in the force of the emotion that Jews were feeling at the time. Let me just read to you one little part of it. He goes through all, Ilu kizaranu ben aguyim lo natan lanu gzerot mimasat salav rishon, right? If you would have just scattered us to the nations and not given us the first crusades, Dayenu. Had you given us the first crusade and not the second crusade, Dayenu. Let me skip all the way to the bottom through Jewish history. He says, Ilu natan lanu et Hitler. Had you given us Hitler and you wouldn't have given us the ghettos, Dayenu. Had you given us the ghettos and you wouldn't have put us in the gas chambers, Dayenu. Had you put us in the gas chambers and you wouldn't have violated and killed our wives and our children and in front of us, Dayenu. Had you violated and murdered our wives, and you wouldn't have worked as hard, Dayenu, etc., etc. This was an incredibly awful thing for people to think, an incredibly awful thing for people to say. But Rabbi Klausner understood that people had to express themselves, and they had to show how they were feeling. This is just the most extreme example of Jews, even good Jews, feeling a reaction to the optimism of the Haggadah Shel Pesach and trying to come to terms with the grief and the torture which they had gone through. So that's just one example. Now, the next, the last part I'll just end with is the stickiness of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. And that is probably the most enigmatic part of the Haggadah Shel Pesach or the Seder, is the ritual itself, and how of all the Jewish rituals in our calendar, it is the most sticky one to exist. People who don't keep Yom Kippur come to a Pesach Seder. People who don't believe in Tzivos Mitzrayim come to a Pesach Seder. And for some reason, Jews of all denominations and Jews of all styles find themselves at a Pesach Seder each year. And, well, why? The obvious question is, why do Jews love the Pesach Seder so much? So the easy answer is, of course, well, it's heebie-jeebies. You know, it's got to be some heebie-jeebies, some Kabbalah or whatever, but if that was true, then why isn't anybody coming to your Tu B'Shvat Seder? Right? If it was just Kabbalah or heebie-jeebies, what is it about the Haggadah Shel Pesach or the Seder which brings Jews every generation back to it? So, this is going to make you laugh, but in walk the anthropologists with on their white horses, and they're here to receive the day. A bunch of Jewish anthropologists got along, like, ritual? That's what we do. We study ritual. We study cultures. We study people hitting each other with scallions. This is perfect. We'll tell you. We will analyze the Seder, and we will tell you why this is such an amazing ritual. They did a terrible job. And I read these books so that you don't have to. And basically, it's really 1980s. They're trying to be hip and cool with the 1980s anthropology and fit in the Seder into the idea of the anthropological transitional states, and that's what creates most effective rituals. I don't buy it, especially because it's really an outside observer's perspective. It's looking from the outside in. It doesn't really understand the Seder from an internal observer's perspective. So I would discount the whole transitional state idea. I mean, there is an interesting idea in there that the beginning of the Seder starts with the past, the middle of the Seder focuses on the present, and the end of the Seder focuses on the future and messianic times. That's a valid point, and other people have noticed this as well, but to say that because it's a transitional state, I'm not going to get started. There's two other points that they do make which are very important, though. One point is, and the easy way to say this is that there's something for everyone in the Seder. But the way anthropologists put this is that this is a multi-channel communication. And if there's noise on one channel, you can always reach the subject on another channel. What this means is that the ritual contains so many different symbols and so many different ways of communicating the values that even if you lose someone, let's say you have someone who doesn't really relate to the stories, doesn't really relate to the Arbakaisis or the matzah as a symbol. For them, you can reach them through some other symbol, right? Maybe they're so surprised that a little girl could say Manashtana all by herself and that we're so into education. There's always, even if you can't reach somebody one way, you always find a way to reach somebody. From my perspective, probably the most simple solution here is because it's about identity, you know, Jewish people. It's about family, and the Seder is about family and identity, and people feel connected to Judaism through the Seder. But that's one idea. The next idea is that this is called symbolic plasticity, which means the symbols are plastic. And this we've seen already in the Haggadah Shel Pesach many, many times, which is that throughout the generations, the symbols which are used in the Haggadah can mean something else in every generation. For example, you could have the Rasha, the son who is a Rasha, one year he's going to be a heretic, and the next year you look in maybe a century later you look in the Haggadah and he's a soldier. Depends on that culture, that place, that time, they're going to interpret the symbols differently. Or if you take the matzah, during worse times, people are going to call it the bread of my affliction. During better times, people think of it as the bread of their freedom. All right, so this is basically where we're going to end for our summary of the origins of Haggadah Shel Pesach. And if anyone has any questions, you'll let me know after, and we're done. So let's kill the recording. All right.